Sure, everybody's getting a little hungry, so try to move things along relatively quickly. I find that things do move perhaps with greater smoothness and quickness if I'm going to try to work without the handout, but I will be following along the sequence of the Makaros in the handout. Started off, I was walking several years ago in the hallway of our hospital, and came across a woman, an obviously religious Jewish woman, who was crying. And she took herself off to the side, seemed very much alone. I couldn't help but go over to her, and I asked her what was the matter. She was a pregnant woman, and she had told me that she had just underwent a fetal echocardiogram by one of my colleagues, where she was given a very devastating diagnosis with three sort of devastating options as what to do about it. The diagnosis was severe aortic stenosis, which is a congenital heart lesion, which alone is amenable to repair, but what she had been told is that it was of such a degree that it appeared to be developing into something called hypoplastic left heart syndrome, which is a very devastating diagnosis. 25 years ago, the treatment was sort of non-existent. There was nothing to do. Subsequent to that, there was a certain series of operations called a Norwood procedure, which was developed. It involves a minimum of three operations. The survival rates are, after the first, in the best of hands, 80-85%, after the first operation, down to 70, down to 60, very poor outcome. And then the best outcomes in that 60% in terms of survival were then destined to a very sort of limited life of expectation maybe 20, 25 years, maybe 30, with also certain morbidity that would be accompanying it over that time. Now, she had been told, and this is, I don't remember, 8-10 years ago, that there was a third option for her. Let me step back a moment. She was told that option number one was termination. She could, now having heard this devastating diagnosis, she can opt out of the whole thing and terminate. The second option was let the baby go to term and then get involved in this Norwood procedure that I just described to you, with all its travail and difficulty and questionable outcome. But what was being pushed by my colleague was the third option. And the third option was very experimental at the time, revolutionary at the time, which was to do a intrauterine fetal intervention. And specifically involved taking a catheter, going through, obviously, the mother, through the uterus, into the heart, and doing something in the hopes of changing the natural history. That if we can open up that aortic valve intrauterine, we will get rid of the whole possibility of this hypoplastic left heart. We'll be left with two good ventricles and a normal life. That was the presentation. What was the experience at that time with this procedure? So there were 11 cases. The first case did not go well, but the second case did, which is always a problem when the second case goes well. The next nine did not go well, meaning there was one success and nine fatalities. So that was her other option. Undergo this procedure where there was a less than 10% chance of any type of success and a 90% chance or more of ending it all right there, which was the equivalent of termination to some degree. So she was distraught beyond, as you can imagine. And what this, I'll give you the ending at the end, what happened in her case, but what it really opens up is an incredible discussion of many significant bioethics topics. Obviously, we won't go through all of them. I'll mention just quickly that there are six major issues that rise from this case. Question number one is termination, which is part of our topic. Is abortion, from a halakhic perspective, a real option in this type of case, where she has the option, let's put aside the experimental option, but she has this option of a Norwood, which I told you has, let's say, 65% survival at the end, with at least for the 25, 30 years, we'll call that chaye olam, that's certainly a life, the child can live a relatively normal life. However, there will be tremendous suffering, possibly, as they go through those surgeries for the family. Does that type of indication have any halachic validity as a reason to do an abortion? That's question number one. Then we have the very common question of who gets to decide for the fetus what should be done for a fetus, or for a small child, or for any incompetent person. Who has the right, al pi din, al pi halacha, to make decisions? Is it the parents, which is the natural approach in general medical situations? Is it the MD, paternalistic or not? Is it the Rav? Should the Rav be involved in such situations? And we'll try to deal with that a little. Next, the question about the decision that needs to be made specifically. Does one have the right to put themselves, this is a classic medical ethics issue, in a position to take a chance on giving up chayisha, let's say a brief life, with a very, very significantly dangerous procedure in the hopes of gaining a normal full life? And really, the nuance in our case is more than that very basic question, which we'll briefly review. It's a little more complicated in our case, is does this woman have the right, or does anyone have the right to go through a situation where you're not trading chayisha for chayolam, a brief temporary life for a full life, but here she has another option that will also possibly be a full life, but can you take a chance and take a risky procedure for the possibility of chayolam tuva, a greater life, greater quality of life? Finally, and this will go to actually one of the questions that Rabbi Starnberg was just asked, is there any special responsibility that the mother may have in this case? Meaning, we're going to have to get into the general ethics question of is a person obligated or permitted to put themselves at risk? Because the mother now, by agreeing to do this procedure, the experimental one, will be putting herself at some risk, at least the anesthetic risk, the risk of the procedure, in order to help somebody else who's bavadai sakana, who definitely has significant risk. And more than that, in the case of a mother and a fetus, a mother and a not-yet-born child, is there an additional sad to say that she has an extra obligation? More than, let's say, a typical Jew for another Jew, is there something special about this maternal-fetal relationship? So those are the six questions that hopefully we'll touch upon. I'll quickly move through abortion. Abortion is a very voluminous topic. I think, though, that it's possible to get a broad, relatively broad understanding of the background for abortion, and the piskei halacha, the halachic decisions that are out there, with the following sort of overview. Number one, there are many gemaras that discuss the concept of ubar yerech imo. Is a fetus considered just the limb of the mother or an independent being inside the mother? And it's a machlokis in at least 10, 12 gemaras. Ultimately, the psak seems to be that we hold, yes, ubar yerech imo, and ubar is a fetus, is considered a limb of the mother. Now, how far does this go? It goes pretty far. We consider, let's say, an avera that the mother does, right? That the fetus, as a limb of the mother, is doing the avera. Ad kidei kach, it's actually in the Shulchan Aruch, by Yom Kippur, you know about kaparos, shlugging the kaparos around the head is done as a hope of kapara, for expiation for a sin that might have been committed. So the Ramah paskins, and the Gra and other Achronim, that the pregnant woman should take care of it for herself and for the fetus, so that the fetus is at least in this metaphysical sense considered a part of the mother, to the point where they also need kapara for any sin that might have been committed. What's interesting, though, is that the fetus, without getting into the details over there, requires their own kapara. You can't just get away with the kapara of the mother. That already begins to allude to the possibility that there is some independent status, despite how we paskin that a fetus is considered a limb of the mother. There is some independent status. Where this comes out even more is in the halachas of treifos. When it comes to a treifa, is, as we know, when it comes to kashrus, to an animal that has a certain wound that would have killed it, let's say, within a year, so that we can't eat that animal, it's not permissible. That's the status of the baby born of a mother who is a treifa. Is the baby also a treifa? So suddenly, even though we're going to paskin, we always consider the baby the limb of the mother in every sense, but not in this one. And Tosfos points out, the Baalei Tosfos point out in the Gemara in Chulin that the reason is because when it comes to chius, when it comes to life, right, the very essence of life, whether someone is a treifa or not, that's an exception. Then we won't say uber yachima, already creating for us a background that there is some independent status to a fetus that we're going to assume, even if we hold otherwise, that a fetus is a limb of the mother. Question is, exactly what? Is it a full independent, equal status of the mother, or is it an ashama gemura, is a full soul, or not? So the litmus test that Chazal will point out the answer to that question is it a capital crime to eliminate a fetus? Obviously, if it were a capital crime, meaning for killing the fetus, you are chayev misa, that you're going to be executed, that alludes to the fact that the fetus is a complete neshama, just like a born person. If not, then not. So what is the answer? So at least we see by Ben Noach, we see right away, it's interesting, shafech dam adam ba adam, damo yishafech, that when it comes to a Ben Noach, when it comes to a non-Israel, clearly it is a capital crime to commit abortion, which we'll see is in the end, when it comes to Allah al-Maisa, doing abortions when they are permitted, it is preferable that it not be done by a non-Jew. This is one of those rare areas where it's better that a Jew should do it than a non-Jew if it is mutter. Now, it is not a capital crime for a Jew, right? Mishnah Nida clearly says that the only time a Jew is chayav misa for killing somebody is after birth. Before birth, no. So that right away now suggests that perhaps when it comes to a Jew doing an abortion and the status of the fetus is less than a full neshama. So that then opens up a very well-known question. Wait a second. So for a non-Jew, it is murder to kill a fetus, but for a Jew it's not. That seems to go against a very, very significant klal that we have in halacha, which is is there anything that is really going to be mutter to a Jew but usher to a non-Jew? That's a general call that we say no. It isn't that we have more mitzvahs. They have 7, we have 613. It's never going to be something that is going to be usher to them and mutter to us. So Tosfos asks this question. And at the end of the day, without getting into details, Tosfos gives the following answer. It says, you know, in achinami, it's true that we have to obey that call. And at the end of the day, we're not saying it's mutter. There's definitely no statement that is explicit in the Talmud that says it is mutter for a Jew to commit an abortion. We're just saying that it's not a capital crime. So the question is, kind of gets us back to the beginning, where are we in terms of abortion? It's not a capital crime, but it's usser. What type of isser is it? One possibility is, it's an isser, it's a prohibition on the level of murder, with a technicality that gets you off the punishment, the onus of murder. If that were true, then we're saying that A, the fetus does have full status, like any born person, and we just, like, the same thing you would see by killing a treifa, if a person, Achmanasan, kills a person who has an injury that would have killed them anyways in the year, so that's certainly an act of murder, and yet they would not get executed because it wouldn't be considered a capital crime for technical reasons. Perhaps that's still the story with abortion. On the other hand, maybe no. Maybe we're saying more than that. We're saying, truth is, a fetus is less than an neshama gemura. It is not full status as a person, and it is not at all an act of murder. It's less. Either a derabanan only. We're going to say, biblically speaking, there's nothing at all wrong for a Jew to kill a fetus. Or we might find that there is a different biblical prohibition. For example, some of the suggestions, chavala, wounding again. Right? You're not allowed to wound another person. Clearly, when you do an abortion, you're wounding the mother, and you're even wounding the fetus. And it might be that that's a biblical prohibition that exists in abortion. Another possibility, even though, as Rabbi Steinberg mentioned, it is not considered, let's say, I think what Shlomo Zalman is going to pass in this way, Hashkata Zera, once you're beyond the act of emission of semen, but there were other Achronim early on that viewed abortion possibly, and even beyond the emission of semen stages, as possibly Hashkata Zera, which could be another possibility for what this Isser Daraisa is. But again, we're left with these three possibilities. How are we going to resolve the three possibilities? So it seems like we need a head-to-head competition. We need some source that compares the status of a fetus to the status of a already born person. So we have that in the Mishnah, and this you can find on page 4 of the handout. Very famous Mishnah, Ha'isha Shehi Maksha Leled, Mechatchines Avlad Demeyeha, a woman who's in the travail of labor, she's having a very difficult time, she's going, her life is in danger. What do we do? So the Mishnah is very clear and very graphic. We will tear this fetus apart to save the mother. We take him out piece by piece, because her life certainly takes precedence over that of the fetus. Yatsarubo, if the fetus is already born, right, defined halachically, Lamaisa, as, let's say, robe of the forehead is out, as soon as that happens, that fetus is no longer a fetus, now it's a baby, so the din is, ain noginbo, you can't touch him. When it comes to two people that are born, you never choose one over the other and say that we're going to destroy one. Well, we'll see, there might be an exception to that. But in general, all things being equal, we don't choose one life over the other. And yet, when it came to the fetus, we certainly did. What's the clear implication? What's Pashut Pshat in this Mishnah? As Rashi tells us in the Gemara Sanhedrin, Pashut Pshat is that she is a full-fledged neshama, a born person. The fetus, Lav Nefeshu, those are the words Rashi uses, is not really a Nefesh, is less than a Nefesh. And that's the simple way of understanding it. If this were the end of the story, so life would be simple in terms of this Shira. It clearly would not be that we would ever consider a fetus a full Neshama. It would not be an act of murder to commit abortion. It would open up for much more flexibility in the Psak in terms of abortion. However, there's a very famous Rambam that much ink has been spilled over. There are many, many perushim on this, very lamdasha ones. There's Reb Chaim, I can list like 10 achronim that have spoken on this Rambam. The Rambam suddenly learns lo kipshuto. He learns this Mishnah very, very differently. And he throws in the concept of a rodef. What is a rodef? A rodef is that one exception I alluded to before where we will sort of choose one life over another. If we see, just to give the simple case, that Reuven is chasing after Shimon with a gun to shoot him, and it's clear to us that he's going to kill him, we don't have to go to court, we take Reuven out. He's a rodef, and a rodef is chayav nasha, we just eliminate him. So the Rambam evokes rodef to explain why we are allowed to choose the mother over the fetus. And by evoking rodef, he is alluding here that otherwise, this would have been an act of murder. The only reason I could take this fetus out is because I consider him to be running to kill the mother. But otherwise, all things being equal, I could not, because ein dochin nefesh, tachas nefesh. And the Rambam clearly seats this halacha within his discussion of the halachas of rodev, really implying that this is what he meant. There are many ways of understanding this Rambam. A lot of them move away, trying to get the Rambam not to be saying what I'm saying. But it could be that Pashut Pshat, certainly the way Rav Moshe Feinstein learned this Rambam, was that he was saying that to kill a fetus is an act of murder. It is only mutter under the conditions of rodef. That means a lot. That means more than pikuach nefesh for the mother. So, for example, if the mother's life is in danger, unrelated to the fetus, she needs a hysterectomy urgently for whatever reason, right, for a different medical problem. She has uterine cancer, Rachman al-Tzan, or something like that, and it isn't the fetus per se who is the rodef, so it could be that under those conditions, that doesn't count, and you would not be allowed, or if she needs chemotherapy, something that could be dangerous to the fetus. Where we don't view the fetus as mamish or rodef, it could be that those who pass in along the lines of Rav Moshe Feinstein in this approach would say even in those cases, you could not do an abortion. Right? And that's really the extreme case. So at the end of the day, let me just summarize the abortion topic, using those sources that we just mentioned. There are really three approaches to the issue of abortion, l'halach. One is this extreme approach that I just mentioned, Rav Moshe Feinstein, relying heavily on the Rambam, although he learns Rashi to agree with him, and he learns many other Makoros to agree with him. That bottom line is that abortion is an act of murder. Absolutely, and technically there's not a chi of misa, but it's a full act of murder. It is only mutter in the place of a rodeh. Then the majority opinion is abortion is certainly not murder. The Pashut Pshat, like Rashi learned, However, it does involve the biblical prohibition, most commonly chavala, wounding. You're wounding the mother. And then the third opinion, the one made very famous by Waldenberg to Eliezer, is he takes it to the other extreme. There is no biblical prohibition at all of abortion, and it's really just an issur d'rabbanan. Of course, not one to take lightly. He emphasizes that. It's not, even according to his, the most makil shita, he's never going to say that one should ever take it lightly. There has to be indication. So, for example, in various cases, depending on which of these three general approaches you hold, that will develop into your final psak. So if there's a danger to the life of the mother, again, Rav Moshe needs a rodeh. The other two, it's a davar pashut. If there's a danger to the mother, of course you can do the abortion. What about when we move to less pressing needs? That's where the real shiloh comes in. So, just briefly, let's say by chavala, are we ever allowed to wound the person? So we mentioned already earlier that yes, of course we do, and anyone who's a doctor has wounded many people, right? For refuah sa'aim. If there's something that we think is medically indicated for the mother, and this is open to a case-by-case analysis, sometimes it's a physical need, and sometimes it's a psychological need. If there's a strong psychological need, and the posek who's dealing with the case decides that this is an absolute danger to the mother, not pikuach nefesh, but a significant enough need that it's considered refuah sa'aim, they will be, certainly according to Rav Waldenberg, and even perhaps within the middle rov shita, be amenable to considering that abortion should be permitted. What about in our case that we started with? The woman who has to choose between abortion, experimental therapy, and the Norwood procedure, that other outcome, I would venture to guess, obviously, you know, the details are always important in this type of psak halacha, casuistry, we're never going to do with principles. So in this case, though, I would say that certainly Rav Moshe Feinstein clearly would not allow this abortion. I think that the chavala shita, the one that's holding it's biblically prohibited, would probably not allow this abortion. I have many patients that have gone through that Norwood procedure, living very full lives, and these are the kind of details that would have to be worked out between the posek and the family, and exactly, you have to really get to know the family, what type of devastation could this potentially do to them or not, right? And even when Waldenberg, I think, would perhaps not allow the abortion in this case. Of course, it's pure speculation. But let's assume, so that we can move on to the other issues, that that option is off the table in our particular case. So what do we have now? So now we have the woman who has to decide she's not going to do abortion. She has to decide either she's going to let the baby come to term and do the conventional Norwood procedure with its chasronos, with its lacking of the same full life that I would be aiming for with the experimental therapy. Now, just to update the experimental treatment, what's fascinating about that experimental treatment, if we go back 10 years, I told you what the abysmal results, right? One lucky outcome, I would call it. They got lucky. But 9 out of, or 10 out of the other 11, immediate fetal demise. Then I would think it comes down to the question of, can I enter a very, very high-risk procedure in order to get a chance at a good life? So we'll see that in a moment. Really, nowadays, things are much better in regards to this treatment. Just to update you in the latest, at Boston Children's Hospital in particular, they have, whether right or wrong, despite the early abysmal results, they continue doing them. And ultimately, that's a whole ethical question in its own right. How do we go about doing that when we get into that situation where we have a treatment with potential, yet it's a very dangerous treatment? Do we keep going and sacrifice the learning curve victims in order to get advanced? But putting aside that issue, they did it. And they've gotten pretty advanced. So nowadays, the data is much better. For example, there is about a 10 to 20% immediate fatality, much less than the 90, 95%. And actually about a quarter, about 25%, made it to this great outcome. It's great if anyone who ever dealt with a hypoplastic patient, to be able to tell the family what two ventricles means as opposed to one is a great thing. And 25% of their cases now get there. 25% are able to go on to, well, I would say, relative normal cardiac life. So how does she make the decision? How do you make such a decision? Who should make the decision? Let's start with that. Who should do it? Is it the parent's decision? If in the general community, certainly in my department, this is the parent's decision, right? They get to choose. Is that the way we would look at it on PTA? So, to some degree, there are makoros that support the idea that parents are the natural apotrosim for their kids, meaning they're the ones we think are certainly, parents are certainly totally looking at the best interest of their children, some degree, and perhaps they should be the ones to make the decision. However, Rav Shachter Shlita from YU is very commonly, I've heard him repeat this many times, in practice and in Shiurim he's given, he quotes a Melamed Lahoil, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, who discussed this issue about who should decide, and actually comes out to say that the parents, in terms of this decision, Lamayla V'Lamor, they have nothing to do with it. They are not the experts on the situation. Totally the MD should make the decision. And that's interesting anti-autonomy approach. But Rabbi Bleich throws in another interesting point, which is, he quotes certain Shvus Yaakov, or certain Achron's approach to these type of situations, where he emphasizes the rabbi must be a significant component of the decision. And Rabbi Bleich offers two reasons for this, which are going to be very relevant to answering up our other questions and are going to come into play in a moment. Why is it so important that not just the parents, if the parents at all, not just the MD, but the Rav has to have a significant part of this, what seems to be, you know, not a technically difficult halachic shaila, but really a personal preference question. One where, if anywhere, autonomy has its place. So for this, I would just like quickly to look at one other makor that's in the handout. And this is on page 11. This is a very famous Gemara in Avodah Zarah. We discussed this Amar Rav Amar Rav Yochanan, Re'amilo Amar Rav Chista Amar Rav Yochanan, Safik Chai, Safik Neis, Ein Misrapin Mehen, Vada Neis Misrapin Mehen. What's the Gemara discussing? The Gemara is discussing the times of the Gemara, certainly when there was an Akum, a doctor who was a Ovid of Avodah Zarah, a Nam B'nei Bris, they were always suspected of, to some degree, wanting to kill us, so that we were not allowed, if we had a chance of survival without them, better not to go to them because you're taking your life and you're basically committing suicide if you go to, or coming close to it, if you go to this doctor. So, Safik Chai, Safik Meis, if it's possible you're going to live, you can't go. What if Vaidai Meis? What if your prognosis is so bad that you're 99% going to die? So then you could go. On what basis is this? So the Gemara tells us that the basis for this is a story from Tanakh about certain lepers that were outside the camp, the Jewish camp. They were being attacked, and there was a siege on the city, and there was a famine, and everybody was going to die, and they had to make a choice. They could either stick it out and live whatever days they had left, Chayisha, limited life, or they could take a chance and go into the enemy camp. Maybe they'll feel bad for them, maybe they'll give them a full life, or they'll kill them right away. So that was the model. Here we have definitely, let's say, a few weeks, a few months. Can I take a chance on being killed right away, losing my weeks, losing my months, in order to gain the possibility that I'll have the full life? And the Gemara says, the Chayisha lo Chayshinan. The Gemara concludes, we don't worry about the limited life, you're allowed to take a chance. And that's the Gemara briefly. So, therefore, the Metzorayim, these lepers, were allowed to go into the enemy camp. It had a happy ending. That's good. And you can go, if you have a horrible prognosis, you can go to even the Ovid of Avodah Zarah doctor and take your chances over there. So what do we learn from this? What do we learn from this? That's the question. And this is where there's a very interesting sort of nuance in different takes that different posts can take on this. So on one simple level, in terms of our original question 10 years ago, could she take a chance on this horrible experimental treatment in order for that little chance of getting chayolam? In other words, the odds are that it's not going to work. 95% it's not going to work. But if it does, it's great. So do we learn from this that she's allowed to do that? So that's a machlokas haposkim. The Achiezer says yes, and other Achronim, Beistavid, they say it doesn't matter how bad the chances are, you're always, when we say the chayisha lo chayshinan, it's almost like saying, we just don't care about it. It's just not significant when the possibility is that you will have chay olam, that you'll get a full life. Others, and this is, I think, the more mainstream approach, like Moshe Feinstein, the Tzitz Eliezer, these other poskim say, no, there's a limit to it. you're allowed to do this taking a chance, but you need at least 50% or more that things will work out well. Otherwise, you're not allowed to take a chance. So that would be the answer to that issue. But again, our question is far more complicated than this. It's not just a question of giving up a little bit of life, taking a chance for a lot of life. Ours is, I have an option that allows me, and this is probably more realistic for most of the decisions that we encounter, I have an option that's pretty good. The NORAD procedure will give at least, and nowadays it's even gotten better, the numbers are 93%, 75%, that they'll have at least a 30-year life. I could do that. Or I can go for the gusto with increased risk of immediate demise. That's a very difficult situation. It does not fit neatly into any of the psak immediately of these poskim. What do I do for that? Can I risk chaye olam? Can I risk a full life for a longer full life or better quality? So on this, you have to go back to that Gemara a minute and understand the way some of the poskim look at it. One blaring element to that Gemara was that it involved lepers. Who are these lepers? So the Gemara tells us these lepers were Gehazi and his children. Who is Gehazi? Without going into detail, he was an Eved, right? Not known to be a very good person, right? He got himself into trouble. That's how he ended up as a Mitzar. And these are not what we would call the paradigms of Jewish virtue, that they should be setting the model of how we should behave. So Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Schechter both emphasize this element. And they say, how is it that we're learning what to do from Rishayim? So it must be that even though we are not into autonomy, right? We are not considered the owners of our bodies to make decisions. We have to get the halacha to help us decide most of the time what we're allowed to do and not allowed to do with our own bodies, right? However, this Gemara is telling me under certain conditions, you are the Baal. You are the owner of your body, and you get to decide. And in other words, Shechter feels very strongly about this approach. Rav Moshe, there's a slight difference between the two of them. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in the setting of this decision of short life, you know, giving up for long life, he'll say it there, and he stops. When it comes to my question about quality of life, Rav Moshe looks at it in a very interesting fashion. He says he doesn't even understand how anyone would ever take a chance for quality of life reasons, take a chance on giving up some length of life. So he says on that, you don't have autonomy on that more complicated decision, only on the original choice between living or dying. But Rav Schechter sees this as a real paradigm case where it shows that there are cases where the person does have full autonomy, and bottom line, on a case like this, it would come down to very much the patient's preference and what the patient wants. It doesn't matter what the doctor says, and perhaps as long as it's within the parameters of halacha, it won't matter what the posek says either. In this type of case, it's really patient preference. Others, however, look at it differently. Rabbi Bleich looks at it the following way. Rabbi Bleich, and this will get back to why he said it's so important to always have a rav involved. He says, no, what we learn is it's true that there is interesting decision-making going on here, but the way it works is we are never the owners of our own bodies. We are never the baal on our guf. We never have full autonomy in that sense. What are we? We are shomrim. We are shomrim who are chayev to, the way he puts it, nishmor kidatri inshin. You have to do a job of watching over your body and your soul that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave you, the way you would be responsible for watching over some object, money, or some valuable object that someone gave you to watch. And he emphasizes that that's more than you would do even with your own property. In other words, you might be willing to take certain risks with your own money, let's say in an investment, but if someone gave you the money, at least if you're a nice person, you would not be willing to take the same risks. And that's the way Rav Bleich says that we should view what happens to our bodies and what happens to ourselves. So he says it gets to be a very nuanced value judgment as to where we have permission to take risks and where we don't. And that was reason number one. Rabbi Bleich said that always it's very important to have the Rav help the patient make this decision. I think that he and Rav Schechter would not necessarily agree on this point. I think that the Rav would be a very big part of the decision which way to go. He gives a second reason also why he would very much want the posek involved. And that is, he refers to a chikre leg in another context. This is another late rabbinic decisor, who said that there's a famous, and I think they're talking about it next door, issue about in a terminally, Rahman al-Atlan, terminally ill case, and there's no hope for recovery, and the person's suffering. It's a famous Gemara about Amsa de Be'rebi, that about you're allowed in Iran, in the Dorim, you're allowed to pray that it should be over. So this Achman said, yeah, that's true, but it can never be the family doing that. The family themselves should not be involved in that prayer. Why is that? Because such a prayer is something that should be only in the hands of the most unbiased third party, somebody who has no negios, is not in any way, for any even subconscious reason, suspicious of having ulterior motives other than what is in the absolute best interest of the patient. For that reason as well, Reb Laich pulls it into our case and says, that's another reason we need a rub. A rub will be that objective third party, and when it comes to these difficult decisions of subtle value judgments in quality of life and in extent of life, we also should have around the rub who is, for lack of a better expression for the moment, with Das Torah, who is able to help guide objectively that decision. The last point, and I'll end with this, is, so at the end of the day, those would be sort of the three ways for the decision to ultimately be made on which way to go. What about the risk to the mother? How do we look at that? Is there any chiyuv or allowance for one person to put themselves at risk when they would be fine? If this woman just would go to term or would terminate or something like that, she would be, let's say, at minimal risk. But if she agrees to this experimental procedure, she's putting herself at some degree of risk that she wouldn't have to do. So this is a famous sugya and a well-known sugya that I'm not going to, it's in your handout, but I'm not going to go through the whole thing. Ultimately, our conclusion is that there is no chiyuv for a person to put themselves at risk to save another, right? And it's very, very, very nogea to the transplant discussions that will take place on Sunday. However, there certainly is a mitzvah. That would be the, I'd say, the mainstream approach, right? You're not chayav to ever put yourself at risk, but there is a mitzvah, at least certainly a mitzvah, not to overestimate the degree of risk. Lo tamen ozan le'echa, in its very makor, in its very source, has situations of a person drowning, a person attacked by animals, a person attacked by bandits, where there is risk. So the Torah does expect some degree of risk, right? And the question is, on a case-by-case basis, is this too much risk or not enough? So clearly, there is no chiyuv ever, even in, if there is an allowance to get yourself into that risk, there would never be a chiyuv to put yourself in some kind of danger to help another person. But is that true for a mother and its unborn child? So Rav Eliyashiv was asked this question by his son-in-law, I think it was Rav Zilberstein, in the following context, just over a C-section. There was a woman who the doctors were saying, in order for the baby to really have the optimal chance of survival, needed to undergo a C-section. The woman had to go into the C-section and not go through a normal delivery. And she was against it. And she refused. She either feared it, I don't know the details of why she didn't want to do it, but she didn't. So the question was, can she be forced to do it? So Rav Eliyashiv paskind that there is a shibud, and this goes to one of the questions earlier, there is a shibud, although there is no chiyuv puravu, right? She does not have an obligation of procreation. And the Meshech Chochma, notwithstanding the Meshech Chochma that says, part of the reason that she doesn't have a mitzvah puravu is because of the sakana involved. The Torah recognizes that there's sakana involved in a woman going through the whole process of having a child. And Chaya Darchei Noam. Nevertheless, Rav Eliyashiv said that in marriage, right, in the suin, as Rabbi Steinberg said, that's the whole point of getting married, right? There is a shibud that she has, an obligation, to facilitate her husband having children. And because of that, and this shibud requires her, by nature, to, by natural reality, to undergo some risk, the risk of having a baby. So Rav Eliyashiv says the additional risk of the C-section is within that geder, it's within those bounds of the risk she's required to do because of the shibud. I should point out two things that are very important caveats to the statement. Number one, Rav Shlomo Zalman did not seem to agree with this talk. He did not see that the shibud, he certainly understood, as Rav Eliyashiv, that there is a shibud for her to go through childbirth, and that degree of risk is expected. However, the additional risk of the C-section he did not think was necessarily expected for the mother. So on that, he disagreed. Furthermore, what Rav Zilberstein points out, Rav Eliyashiv's son-in-law, in regards to this issue that's related to our case, if the fetus is suffic in terms of its ultimate outcome, if the fetus is not a guaranteed or likely normal baby, but might not even make it, he says that even Rav Eliyashiv would agree there is no shibud on the mother to go through the additional risk in that type of case. So Lamaisa, in our case, I think that Rav Eliyashiv would say certainly the woman does not have to undergo this or agree to it. She has the right, despite her other shibud, to have children and facilitate her husband's pruvu. She still does not have to take on this type of extra risk. And at the end, I'll just tell you, in terms of what ultimately happened with this woman, she, at the time, I advised her not to be part of that learning curve and certainly not to get involved in that experimental treatment. And Baruch Hashem, she had a baby. It turned out to be very successful Norwood procedure, and they're both doing fine. Baruch Hashem. Okay. Thank you very much. Right. If by that you mean baby born and then no prostaglandin, right. Right. Will not survive. Right. Right. The truth is, when these options are presented by, I have to admit that I don't necessarily present that option, but the, in general, most pediatric cardiologists that are making this diagnosis will present that fourth option. I have not encountered, even though all my colleagues are presenting it, I've never encountered any of them taking it. No one in our time takes that. It used to be the only option. Right. Which is a very good point. The truth is, when I will speak to them, when I make this diagnosis and I'm speaking to the family, to the usually the father and the mother, I definitely bring that up because there is certainly literature out there now discussing it. But you have to be careful. And there is literature that shows when they compare hypoplastic left heart children later in life compared to others, so there is a whole spectrum of outcomes. Some, like Rabbi Steinberg was saying about the Down syndrome over here, even, I think, to a sharper degree, because there is what's considered in the literature, oh, there's a significant difference, sometimes it's learning disability. So they're advancing in school, but they're not advancing at a normal pace. They may be having more trouble in school, they need tutors. There is a whole spectrum of outcome. It needs to be mentioned to be factual and truthful. It's hard to know, is that a consequence of all the surgeries? Or is that something that's somehow related to the underlying genetic issue or multifactorial environmental genetic issue that led to the hypoplast? Is there something affecting neurological development that also is responsible? Because which one of those two it is will then declare whether by undoing the natural history of the heart problem, we can also correct that. It could be yes. If it's related to the surgeries, then yes. Right? These babies are born cyanotic and they need... Right. Well, it, right. Right. Right, 100%. What that goes to is when I had mentioned earlier with the three general approaches to abortion, so certainly Rav Moshe Feinstein would not be interested in what you're saying right now in terms of his psak by abortion. But the other two would take it, when I said we have to take the whole picture, this is a really a case-by-case issue. You have to know two things. You have to know realistically, fully, what is the outcome of the child, and what is the ability of the family to handle it, and what would be the consequences. And all of that goes into that decision, 100%. All right, thank you.
Enjoy the afternoon. We're back at 6 o'clock.